This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just 1 month ago, the smoke began to clear in Baghdad. With the tough battles over and the crowds cheering American troops, the immediate prospects look good in Iraq. While few underestimated the difficulties of building a representative government, the quick military victory had not damaged as much of the infrastructure as many had feared. Once electrical power, water, and sanitation could be restored, life could begin to return to normal. More than a month later, U.S. officials are struggling with Phase 1. Services are spotty, looting continues, security is often non-existent, and the country is plagued with shortages of gasoline. Now Washington has initiated a regime change as one set of American administrators arrives and another gets set to leave. What's going on? Later in the hour, the latest development in the anthrax investigation. A tipster has sent investigators to a pond near Frederick, Maryland. But first, the current situation in Iraq and the short-term prospects for reconstruction. If you have questions about the condition of Iraq's infrastructure, shortages, planning, and the role of American-led forces, give us a phone call. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Baghdad is NPR's Guy Raz, who's with us by satellite telephone. Good to talk with you again.
Hi, Neil.
And I guess we have to begin with the news of a couple of big former Iraqi officials being captured or turning themselves into American officials. And the first, I guess, is Ibrahim Ahmad Abd al-Sattar Mohammed al-Tikriti, the former Iraqi Armed Forces Chief of Staff.
That's right, Neil. He was number 11 on the list of the 55 most wanted by the U.S. and British forces. That makes about 24 of those 55 officials now in coalition custody. So it's quite a significant capture. There have been very few details on his arrest. There have been more details, however, on the arrest of another highly important former weapons official here in Iraq, a woman called Dr. Rehab Rashid Taha. And she held a very senior position in Iraq's biological weapons program. She was known as Dr. Germ. Now, only about 10 or 11 days ago, her husband, who was a former official in the oil ministry here, turned himself in. So now, with her capture, with her surrender, rather, most of the former scientists who worked on Iraq's alleged weapons program, biological weapons program, are now in coalition custody.
Well, let's turn to the broader situation and civil services. To what extent is electrical power, water, to what extent is that working in Baghdad?
I think you summed it up very, very well in your introduction. It's very bad, spotty, inconsistent. I can tell you that we're fortunate enough to have a generator here at the hotel where we're staying, the small hotel, but we still have about 6 or 7 hours of power a day. Most people in Baghdad do not have regular, consistent power. In large parts of the city, there is no power at all, which means there's no clean water. And it's an enormous frustration for people trying to go about their daily lives, trying to get things done, because it's so difficult to imagine how you sort of get through the day without without having regular power and water. It's something that has become an enormous source of frustration for people in the city.
The other thing, of course, the basis of any civil existence is security. There were reports of looting still going on.
Yeah, I've seen it myself. It's quite extraordinary. In fact, yesterday there was a fire that broke out at the former communications ministry, and it was immediately clear that that fire was set as a diversion for looters to go and enter nearby buildings and steal remaining bits of wire or light fixtures. I mean, you see young men with large carts heading down toward abandoned buildings, coming out of those buildings with the most bizarre things, window panes and light fixtures, wires. I mean, things that you can't imagine what they would do with them. But within a few hours, you see those items sold on the streets. I was at a looter's bazaar, I guess you would call it yesterday. It was a bazaar. Mm-hmm. And there I saw people sending, selling engines and motors and various bits of electrical wire. It was very strange indeed.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We have a caller for you, Guy. Amy's on the line with us from Palo Alto, California.
Hi, thanks. Hi. I'm calling because I heard a report that the medical services before and during the war were actually in much better condition and were providing more aid to people than they are currently. And I was wondering if you could talk about whether medical services are going to be prioritized and if there's a chance of people getting what they need anytime soon. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Amy.
Sure.
It's a very good question, and part of the problem is that there are so many priorities. As Neil mentioned in his introduction, water, power, security, healthcare. It's very difficult to walk into a hospital and receive basic medical care now, and the caller is right. In fact, before the war, medical services, while not exceptional, were there. I mean, they existed. There was some kind of functioning health service in the country. And part of the problem, and I think that we can talk about this more later, is that in Iraq, power authority was so centralized that even doctors, even medical practitioners, lab technicians, haven't been coming back to work because nobody's told them to go back to work. Most of these people, rather all of these people, were government employees. So many of the hospitals are understaffed or not even staffed at all.
What about these basic supplies of drugs, things like that? Are there these kinds of things available now?
Well, there are shortages of drugs. There are shortages of basic medical supplies. I know that the International Red Cross is here trying to fill some of those gaps, and the United Nations just recently returned, but. Absolutely. I mean, there are shortages of all kinds of basic medical supplies, in part because so many of the hospitals in the city were looted, and so many of those supplies, a huge quantity of medicine was taken from these hospitals.
And today we had a new American civil administrator arrive there in Iraq. Paul Bremer, a counterterrorism expert formerly with the State Department, replaces retired General Jay Garner. What is going on with this change of command in Baghdad? Is this what was planned all along? And we also know that some of the subordinate administrators underneath Jay Garner are planning to leave very soon.
Yeah, that's right, Neil. The officials here at the Civilian Reconstruction Office, it's called ORHA, the Office for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Aid, say that this was long in the works, but it's very clear that it's part of a major shakeup here in this civilian administration. Jay Garner, as you mentioned, he will remain in Iraq for the rest of the month, but you know, his tenure now is widely being seen as a failure. Privately, people who worked around him said that there wasn't the kind of sufficient planning in Kuwait when this group was organizing the post-war reconstruction efforts. For example, they didn't properly anticipate the breakdown of law and order in Baghdad. And so what had happened was they arrived to the city, and immediately there was this chaos. There was rampant looting. There was crime. I mean, power and water were power plants and water purification factories were looted. They simply didn't anticipate it, and so they arrived here and they were overwhelmed by this enormous problem. And Jay Garner, I suppose, in a sense, is sort of falling on his sword for this.
One more question from a listener for you, Guy, before we let you go. Samira joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an Iraqi-American, and I have a family, quite a bit of family living in Iraq still, in Baghdad. And I had a brief opportunity to talk to them the other day. They got a hold of a satellite phone through a peacemaking group there of Americans and Canadians and had a chance to call and talk to us. And the overwhelming impression I got was that this is sort of like a party that the Americans are throwing, but no one bothered to show up. the average Iraqi family there seems to be totally in the dark as to what's going on, and they're so scared and isolated and such a lack of communication that they're just staying in their homes for fear of what, not a lack of knowledge of what's going on and lack of safety and that sort of thing. So what I wanted to know is, what sort of communication is there between the American forces there and the average Iraqi on the street or in their homes, and is it effective and is it working? Because they don't really seem to know much about what's going on, and that's creating a big problem for the average people.
Mm-hmm. Guy?
It's such a good question, and it's been, I would say, the key failure of the civilian administration here. Barbara Bodine, the woman who was recently reassigned to the State Department, she left Baghdad yesterday. She was actually in charge of central Iraq and Baghdad, so she was effectively the mayor of the city. Nobody who I spoke to here, no resident in the city, had ever heard of her. Nobody ever saw her. In the 3 weeks that I've been here, I never saw her. Many of the civilian administrators have been very cautious. I think part of the problem is that when they arrived here, they really didn't want to appear as if they were authoritarian. There were, you know, of course, there's been talk of the United States being colonizers, and there was a fear of sort of giving that impression. So they really took a soft touch. I mean, they came here, they stayed in the background, they stayed behind high walls and behind barbed wire and soldiers. And it's been very, very difficult for the average Iraqi, particularly in Baghdad, to get any kind of information, to know what's going on, to know who's in charge. And it's an enormous problem.
Are telephones back up? What about radio and television, though obviously with spotty power? Those are going to be difficult to manipulate as well. And is there anything like a newspaper available in Baghdad?
Actually, newspapers are slowly starting to emerge. There are several Kurdish papers in the country, and I understand that an English language paper is in the works. In terms of radio, the U.S. military is trying to set up a nationwide radio station that's not fully functional yet. Same with a television network. Telephones are a much bigger problem. They work in parts of Mosul in the north and in Kirkuk, but you can't call from Mosul to Kirkuk or from Kirkuk to Mosul. Same in Baghdad. Certain neighborhoods, I mean, maybe three square blocks, have telephone access, and they can call one another. But trying to call into Baghdad is virtually impossible because the telephone network was completely damaged during the war, in part because the telephone exchange here in Baghdad, which controls the entire country, was bombed by coalition forces.
Samira, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Guy, just before we let you go, what can you tell us about the morale of U.S. forces who are still engaged in patrolling, though a lot of people think there aren't enough of them?
You know, the morale among the soldiers that I speak to every day is quite high. I mean, they know, they feel as if they have done a noble task by liberating the country. But there is a sense, and a growing sense, that they are really stretched thin. Iraqis are asking for security, yet there are no police officers in the country. And you simply cannot police a country with 24 million inhabitants the size of California with 170,000 coalition soldiers, most of whom, you know, are guarding buildings or are guarding installations that are occupied by American administrators. It's a very, very difficult task for them.
Guy Raz, thanks very much for speaking with us. As always, when we talk to somebody from Iraq, we know it's late and you're up there cuddling your generator. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Neil.
NPR reporter Guy Raz joining us by satellite telephone from Baghdad. We're talking about America's reconstruction effort in Iraq, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the progress in the reconstruction of Iraq and Phase 1, the reestablishment of security, water, power, medical attention, all the basics of life in Baghdad and the other cities and towns of Iraq. You're invited to join the discussion, of course. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Arthur Helton, Director of Peace and Conflict Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's with us by phone from his office in New York City. Good of you to join us.
Thanks, Neil.
And also with us here in Studio 3A is Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel and consultant to the Defense Department. Sam, good to have you back.
Neil, good to be here.
Arthur Helton, first of all, this change of leadership in Baghdad, what do you think this is going to do in terms of, is this substance or is this simply a matter of style?
Well, I think it's probably reflective of the continuing quarrel between the Defense Department and the State Department in an effort to resolve that particular bureaucratic problem to some extent. I think it probably has little effect or little consequence in terms of the larger issues confronting the administration in Iraq and the new civil administration. These are just such daunting problems that essentially, rearranging the deck chairs is not going to do much to diminish them.
Mm-hmm. Sam Gardner, I know that on this program and elsewhere, you've talked about the unwillingness of U.S. officials to think about planning ahead of the war.
Neil, there was a lot of optimism about how this thing would go. And I think part of the problem we have now is the admitting that that may have been wrong. It's so interesting to me that everybody except the Pentagon will say we're too thin in Iraq. You get emails from soldiers, they say we're too thin. The relief organizations say the American military is too thin. The UN says the American military is too thin. I just think the only way we're going to take a step to solving this, Neil, is we got to get more troops there. Mm-hmm. There has to be the security before anything else falls in place. And I certainly agree with Arthur that you don't get security by adding another ambassador in Baghdad.
Arthur, is security, this is the basis of everything. You start from there, correct?
Well, you really do, because it's a prerequisite to doing anything in terms of delivering essential services. You can't even begin to think about organizing a representative government or building institutions or reviving an economy until you have basic security. Frankly, if you delivered all of those medicines to these hospitals, if they were looted the next day, you wouldn't be accomplishing much in any event. So you really do need security, and we don't really have a toolbox that permits us to do that. We don't have police forces. We don't have the kinds of tools that other nations do have, and there is some experience in the UN that could have helped on this.
Sam Gardner, some things we should not overlook. I mean, there are not wide-scale revenge killings going on in the country as some people feared, and the infrastructure is not as badly damaged as some people feared, and nor is there widespread hunger.
Not so fast. I received an email last night, Neil, from a Kurdish woman who's the head of a Kurdish relief organization who said, in the north, they only have 10 days worth of food left. Somehow, very quickly, we have to find a way to get major supplies of food to millions of people in the Kurdistan area.
Mm-hmm. But that's in the northern part of Kurdistan that was autonomous before?
It is in the autonomous region. So very interesting that Baghdad controlled their food supply under the Oil for Food program. So that really stopped before the war started. So, but the other thing is, Neil, that if you read, the planting for this year is behind. No fertilizer. The pumps for the water to fertilize or to irrigate are not there. So you're right. No immediate hunger right now, but the problems are beginning to unfold.
Okay. Let's get back to the phones. Our number again is 800-989-8255. Our next caller is Ken, who joins us from Bend, Oregon.
Good morning. Thanks. Still morning here in the West Coast. Thanks for taking my call. A lot of this discussion has seemed to focus or center around what the American and British forces have done or what they have failed to do. One of the things I remember from the very early days when the coalition forces rolled into Baghdad is at least one of the correspondents got off on a little side trip and visited a lot of the neighborhoods that weren't directly involved in the hostilities, and reported back seeing the most grinding poverty he had ever seen in his world travels, which leads me to wonder how much of what we're attributing now to omissions or commissions on the part of the coalition forces is really attributable to pre-existing conditions, and how much inertia are we trying to overcome right now, cultural inertia?
Arthur Helton?
Well, certainly it was well known that there were really problems in terms of the social infrastructure in Iraq by reason of a decade or so of sanctions. I mean, the Oil for Food program was launched in 1996 to try to mitigate the impact of sanctions on the Iraqi people by delivering food, medicine, and other essentials. And that worked to some extent, but no doubt we're starting with a very degraded baseline. This is going to be close to a humanitarian problem for a while. The combat and the conflict itself certainly disrupted what little there was in terms of social services, infrastructure, and whatnot. The looting and lack of security has compounded that. So certainly to win the hearts and minds of the ordinary Iraqi people, we're going to do something pretty dramatic pretty soon. I mean, that's a tall order for Paul Bremer or anyone else.
And Sam Gardner, I know some of the problems with the water and the power go back 12 years.
Yes, yes. Well, the electrical system at the start of this war was about half in terms of capacity of what it was in 1990. Only 60% of the people of Iraq were getting good water when this war started. But I guess I would add, Neil, we knew that. And so we left the people with Iraq with expectations. And when you know that, we could have prepared. I mean, there are ways, knowing that it was in such disrepair, that we could have done it. But Ken's right. It also, we should remember that sanctions have done part of this.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the problems with the water system, including a shortage of chlorine, has been because of the sanctions in the Oil for Food program.
And chlorine obviously used to purify water.
Right.
Ken, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Roberta, and Roberta's on the line from San Francisco.
Oh, hi, Neil.
Hi.
Good to hear from you guys today. Very quickly, here's my question. You know, we did know many things from 10 or 12 years ago about Iraq. And my question is, why didn't we think about this on a more regional basis and utilize the strengths and employees of the area who are working with the power, you know, working with water, you know, some of the people who are in the police forces, and go on a regional basis and be a little more organized in our approach to work with the Iraqi people? Then it looks like, you know, one, you know, they're working with engineers and such, and they would be part of the redevelopment of their country. They would feel empowered instead of being afraid and trampled on, I think.
Mm-hmm. Arthur Helton, a regional approach?
You know, I actually think we probably will back into that to some extent. We undertook this campaign largely alone, and we've undertaken the efforts to win and build the peace largely alone. I think that we will find that that's very difficult. Our system is one essentially where you have a group of smart people improvising furiously, and you can change the composition of that group of people from time to time, but it's still essentially an ad hoc, muddling along effort. I think we will turn to regional resources and turn to international resources as we discover how hard this is.
Mm-hmm. Sam,
I'm sorry, Neil, but I just wanted to, I mean, if we had done a regional approach, it seems to me that people, the people would already be in place and cleaning things up and getting things available to their own Iraqi people, whether it's food or power or police services. And it seems like we've really been lagging, unfortunately.
Roberta, what you seem to be talking about, a localized approach rather than a regional approach, which Sam Gardner has a lot of political problems.
Correct. The other thing...
Some areas, I think we could be very strong, and I think it would show, let's say, in Basra, as an example, or even in Mosul, we might have shown, oh, look, the Americans are working with the local Iraqi people. We're trying to get things under control here.
Mm-hmm.
And the people working could, you know, tell other people, yeah, this is, you know, we're doing the work here. We're putting food on our table for our children and our family, too.
Roberta, so, it's very interesting. The U.S. Agency for International Development put out a contract proposal, which I think over 25 agencies may have bid on, that will begin probably in July with what they call a community action program. And the notion is to organize at the grassroots level, to have the villages, the neighborhoods identify their needs, and then to have those satisfied. It's very interesting. It flips on its head the approach we've taken so far, which is to start with Baghdad and think outwards. But I think your idea is probably the way this thing is eventually going to be solved.
I mean, in fact, if you don't do that, you've essentially ceded Iraq to a number of other political forces. Mm-hmm. You can bet right now that there are parties, some of which are religiously based, doing exactly that in Iraq.
Arthur Helton, I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes, but I wonder if you would talk about what you see as the immediate priorities and just look a little bit beyond that as well to the months to come.
Well, look, it's really security, 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 as people are fond of saying. If we can right away try to assemble as many resources as we can from other like-minded actors and international organizations, look, Spain, France, and Italy have the kinds of constabulary forces that we need to introduce into this situation. If we can focus on rebuilding the legal system, judicial system, delivering those essential services at the community level, which is really where the battle will be fought in terms of the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, then there's a chance for marshaling all those experiences and expertise to see some kind of participatory government, some kind of revival of a shattered economy. Without that, it will just be a mixed outcome, which I think will be considered a loss and a failure to win the peace.
As you look ahead, does any kind of timetable present itself to you? I know that the United States has said, as long as we're needed, not one day longer. That's not a very concrete time proposal.
That may be accurate, though, and that translates into several years, if not, a decade or so. We are there. We have a responsibility, and it's going to be a long time before we can quit with any kind of responsible approach.
Arthur Helton, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Neil.
Arthur Helton is Director of Peace and Conflict Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he joined us from his office in New York. Among today's headlines from NPR News, health workers investigating SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, say they've identified specific practices that led to the spread of the virus. NPR's Joe Palca reports from Hong Kong from the hospital where SARS was first discovered, and we'll have more from NPR's Guy Raz on the changes in the U.S. leadership in Iraq, and you'll be able to hear those stories in greater detail later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And retired Colonel Sam Gardner is still with us here in Studio 3A, and we'll go back to more of your calls. Our next caller is Jeff, who's with us from Quincy, Illinois.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My question has to do with what apparently, and I'm not an anti-war activist and somewhat neutral on this adventure, is we spend a lot of time, effort, and money to ensure military victory. Both the opponents and proponents were pretty well agreed that we would win, but it appears that there was negligence in regard to the planning and allocation of resources for the occupation and reconstruction. Now, is this Pentagon or White House? And when are we likely ever to find out, because a presidential campaign is coming up?
There's always a presidential campaign coming up, but go ahead, Colonel Gardner.
Jeff, I think I can answer your question, and I would say it is both the White House and the Pentagon. Let me use a couple examples. I had some occasion before the war to go around town briefing people on what I thought would be the humanitarian situation, humanitarian disaster. The Pentagon, although was very polite, seemed to be confident that they knew what was going to happen. In fact, there was a press report or a press conference by Rumsfeld's number one guy, who was supposed to do the preparation for this. He said, in response to a question in that press conference in February, water won't be a problem when we get in there because most of the people of Iraq drink bottled water. Now, he obviously they weren't preparing for this. I heard from discussions from people from the National Security Council who said, well, we pretty well got the humanitarian situation in hand. The president has spent an hour on it already. I'm sorry. I think that I could. There's enough blame to go around, and we were not prepared for what we're now encountering.
Jeff?
Well, I hope more press attention is devoted to this whole issue, because it's really extraordinary that the position from Washington is, our victory is a great surprise, so we need more time to figure this thing out. And they spent months planning the military victory and did a fine job with that, and they're not doing very well right now, and we may have won the battle but lost the war if we don't get our act in gear pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, sir. Thanks for the call, Jeff.
And I could, just to push this noodle a little farther, Neil, you remember in, I think it was late November, early December, that General Franks had this major war exercise in Gutter,
mm-hmm.
where he were preparing the war. They only went to the surrender. They didn't do anything beyond that.
Is this lack of, short-sightedness? Not lack of short-sightedness. Is this short-sightedness? Or is this an effort, do you think, to try to do this on the cheap?
It is those both. And, Neil, it is also, this was an unnatural act. And I mean that in the sense that, I remember a Pentagon general officer telling me as we were discussing the humanitarian thing, he said, you know, Sam, I've been to meetings and I look around the room and I've never seen these people before. Meaning he had never seen the people from the Agency for International Development and the relief organizations that he had to deal with. It has been since World War II, Neil, that we have invaded and then been responsible for fixing it afterwards. See, in all the other places, a little bit in Kosovo and Bosnia, but all the other places...
A little bit in Kuwait as well.
During the last war, yes. But it wasn't in the sense of an occupying power. But, so that in ways this was all new. The military, I've taught at war colleges for about 20 years. I never taught students how to do this, and my students were in charge this time.
When we come back from our break, we'll wrap up our discussion with Sam Gardner about reconstruction in post-war Iraq. Also coming up, NPR's David Kestenbaum will join us to talk about a possible development in the government's continuing anthrax investigation. Case never been solved. You can call us at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll also have your letters. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a few minutes, the latest on the anthrax investigation. We'll also have your letters. But right now, we're talking about the reconstruction of post-war Iraq. Our guest is Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel and consultant to the Defense Department. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Russ, who's on the line with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi.
Just
wondering about, what the expectations of the Iraqi people are. It seems like that if we named an end date, no matter what, this day we're gone, wouldn't that kind of induce them to do more while we're still there and kind of put them at ease about the whole, fear of occupation thing?
Fear of colonization might be a way to put it, Russ. That's one of the concerns, Colonel Gardner?
Well, I think, Russ, that managing the expectation of things has been one of the difficult problems we've had. They expected by the announcements that we made before that we were going to fix things relatively quickly. So I think your point about the expectations management is something we've got to catch up on.
Mm-hmm. But setting a date just before the break, Arthur Helton was saying, this could be years.
It could be, but you can't set a date. Mm-hmm. This is one case where Rumsfeld is right, that it's unknowable, but you have to set. I think objectives would be better, Neil. For example, if you could say, we want everybody in Iraq to have quality water in 6 months. If we want electricity for 90% of the population in 7 months. So I think those are the kind of objectives that might be better.
Mm-hmm. Russ, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
And one final question. Susie is calling from Orange County, California.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just feel that people aren't giving the military there enough time to do their job. I think it's going to take longer than a month to bring, you know, all the water supplies back to normal, all the electricity back to normal. And I think people are just pushing the gun. They're expecting too much in a short period of time.
Sam?
Well, I must say, Susie, I don't mean to come down on your question, but we're killing Iraqi. That's the thing. We said our war was not against the people of Iraq, but not having clean water. There is cholera in Basra. In Basra, there are 300 cases a day of children with diarrhea because of drinking bad water. And you know what? The children that get diarrhea, where that goes when they're weak, and that's the situation. So, I mean, it's not just repaving the streets of Baghdad.
I understand that, but with the destruction that was done, it's evident it's going to take quite a bit of time to bring everything back to normal, and it is going to take a long time, and I think we need to understand that we are trying our best, but it is going to take time. It can't all happen in 1 month.
Colonel Gardner, you were talking about, first of all, the battle of expectations. The Iraqis mm-hmm. were certainly led to believe that this might happen more quickly. And there's also a sort of leeching of political capital as this situation goes on.
Yes, well certainly I think, you know, when somebody says, when does this have to be solved, the answer is it's probably got to be solved in the next 6 to 8 months because there's an election coming up. So there's a positive pressure for elections, too.
But, Susie, your point is well taken. A lot of people said the military wouldn't get the victory done in time, and they certainly did
that. Right. Well, thank you. I hope everyone stays positive about this.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm sure we're going to do our job.
Thanks very much for the call. And Sam Gardner, good to have you back with us here in the studio.
Neil, thank you.
Sam Gardner is a retired Air Force colonel and a defense consultant. He was with us here in Studio 3A.